I do very brief introductions normally because I always figure that you've got the bio notes and you can Google if you want to find out more about a speaker, and if you don't, save us all a lot of time, really. The other good thing about it is that, well, it doesn't get embarrassing because Professor Andy Pittman has far too good a CV to read out. In brief, he is Professor of Climate Science at the University of New South Wales. He's Director of the ARC Centre of Excellence for Climate System Science, among other things. He was a lead author of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate... You can see why they just call it the IPCC, don't you? The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, third and fourth assessment, and he was a review author, a review editor of the fifth IPCC report. So, unlike Alan Jones, I think our first speaker actually knows what he's talking about. Please welcome Professor Andy Pittman.
Thank you very much for that introduction. Almost too embarrassing, but I'll move on. So I'm going to give you a quick 15 or 20 minutes on issues close to my heart, which are around climate change, climate variability and climate extremes. And I'll try not to watch what tweeted questions come in case they annoy me. Quick background to what's going on with global warming. I'll talk briefly about what the trends are in emissions, touch on the implications for a variety of interesting perils, and then touch very briefly on the implications for emissions and depths of cuts required. If you're going to report on me, do it early because it gets depressing towards the end, and the feedback can sometimes reflect that. So, it's warming. This is a map of the globe. I showed this not long ago and people said it doesn't look too bad. There's lots of blues. Those aren't. They're purples. And the purples are bigger amounts of warming than the reds. If you've got sharp eyes, you can find an area of blue. It is the North Atlantic, part of the Gulf Stream, and that's not a good news story. Those of you who know what happens if the thermohaline or the Gulf Stream weakens, it's not a good news story that that appears to be cooling, unless, of course, you'd like Western Europe to be 8 or 10 degrees colder within a decade or so. I'm not predicting that that's going to happen, by the way, but global warming doesn't negate regional cooling. Other than that, most of the planet is warming. If it's got a dot, it's a statistically significant warming. And where it's white, we don't have any data, and it's probably warming there too. If you average that up to decadal timescales, and climate scientists worry no more about what happens in an individual year than you should worry about what happens in an individual year to your superannuation portfolio, we worry about decades and 20 years and 30 years because it takes that long to tease out a signal against the background variability, which is well known in the climate system to be driven by things like El Niño and La Niña cycles. If you look at the warming over the decadal timescales, each of the last 3 years has been progressively warmer at the Earth's surface than any of the preceding decades. And as I said earlier today, 2014 looks like being the record winner, the hottest year on record. Some people have got terrifically excited about the fact the global mean air temperature hasn't warmed much in the last 10 or 15 years, which doesn't get the climate... Well, it does actually get the climate scientists excited because we think it should have cooled by 0.2 degrees because we've been in a solar minimum and we've been in a sustained, unprecedentedly long period of La Niña, which tends to cause global cooling. The fact the Earth hasn't cooled by 0.2 degrees is something that has us somewhat concerned. But I just want to draw the attention to the extremes that really worry people, like temperature extremes, maximum temperature extremes, haven't paused. Whilst the global mean temperature has temporarily plateaued, and it is temporary because we can measure the heat content in the ocean is still going up at a tremendous rate, and it's natural variability that has caused the pause in mean warming, extreme temperatures continue to rise. And none of you, as you get old, will be killed by the mean temperature. It is the heat waves that knock people over. Talking of heat waves, these are noisy because they're based on observations and there is a lot of noise in the climate system. But for most of Australia, we are increasingly getting more heatwave days. In itself, a hot day isn't overly worrisome. But we're also getting more heatwave events. In other words, the hotter days are getting hotter, and the events that string together hot days are getting longer. They're also getting earlier. There is a slow trend, well, fairly slow trend, in how early heatwave conditions begin to impose themselves on us. And heatwaves are getting, therefore, longer, earlier, and more intense. That is a bad news story for a lot of interesting phenomena, like bushfires. If you've elevated CO2 in the atmosphere and your vegetation is growing a bit more actively, fixing carbon, and then you get an early season heat wave that kills off some of the vegetation, it's called fuel, and it burns really well. And we have seen an increasing frequency of early bushfires in Australia. Sea level is rising. If I find one more person talking to the Australian to say the sea level hasn't risen at their beach, I'll scream. It is the global sea level, not the sea level at every individual beach on the planet. This is a combination of fixed stations measuring sea level rise and satellite measurements. People can build satellites now to measure sea level to within millimeter accuracy. Please don't ask me how. Over the 20th century, sea level has risen by 0.19 metres, which is quite a lot if your house happens to be built very near to the ocean. This appears to be unprecedented in at least the last 2,000 years, and it's probably unprecedented since the end of the last ice age. Emissions of carbon dioxide are increasing. They're increasing above the rate that was believed to be technically feasible. So back in 1990, people worked out how technologically capable we were as a species to dig stuff out the ground, coal, shift it to somewhere where you burn it, and burn it to release the CO2. And it wasn't thought really technically possible to be burning it at quite the rate that we are, again illustrating how adaptable we are as a species. The little white dot, which you can see just above about 2010, is the GFC. The global financial crisis cut global emissions of carbon dioxide for about 6 weeks' worth, which gives you a hint of the scale of the economic transformation necessary to turn the emissions to zero, because that's what we actually have to end up doing. We're currently emitting somewhere around 10 billion tonnes of CO2 a year. That's about 10 cubic kilometres of coal vaporised annually, which is quite an impressive achievement. It's sarcasm when I point to the dramatic reduction in emissions since the first IPCC report in 1990. In 1990, the climate science community said we have to reduce emissions, and you can see how effective we have been at communicating that message. I also want to draw your attention to a particular emission scenario, so-called A1F1, which is that purple line. The black dots are the actual observed emissions, and the purple line is A1F1, which was believed to be one of the upper possible emission scenarios. And I want you, just for future reference, to note that we are exceeding that rate, because I'll come back to that in a minute. As a consequence of all of this, as I mentioned, we're getting more heat waves. That's starting to cost serious money. More people died in the heat wave leading up to Black Saturday than in the actual bushfires, and there is no science to explain that heat wave without taking into account the human emissions of CO2. It can be attributed to human activity. We're expecting heat waves to double by 2030 and triple by 2070. I put a caveat on that, which is the climate scientists have been proven pretty ineffectual at estimating how fast extremes will change. We have an extremely impressive track record of underestimating how fast extremes will change. Bushfire risk is going up. Each of these fine grey lines is an individual meteorological station across Australia. The thicker lines are the trends, and the dashed line is a regression. But really, almost for any meteorological station you will go to in the country, there is a gradual upward trend in the bushfire risk. And if you look at the more extreme conditions, those are increasing faster than the more typical conditions. I was asked to mention briefly some uncertainty in terms of projecting into the future. So the grey, the blue wavy line at the bottom of this slide is the observational record over the last 1,500 years, with an estimate of the uncertainty in that reconstruction over that time. The red area is the observational record based on thermometers, and then we move forward into the future with a green area, which is very low emissions, orange, which is higher emissions, and this A1F1 scenario, which I mentioned earlier. And if you remember, I mentioned we are currently exceeding the emissions associated with that emission scenario. So this is the uncertainty into future projections associated with emission scenarios. So if you hear that the climate scientists are inept because we can't tell you how much the planet will warm by from anything from 1.5 to 4.5 degrees, most of that range is to do with how we decide to deal with emissions in the future. If we cut emissions deeply, we're down at the 1.5. If we carry on as we're going, we're up high on that scale. This is the uncertainty linked with modelling. There is uncertainty linked with modelling, and it's a small, a third or so of the uncertainty related to emissions. So the elephant in the room is not the climate science. The elephant in the room is what we do as a species around cutting future emissions. You'll note that that 1.5 to 4.5 degrees, the top range of that is this A1F1 scenario. And everyone thinks about the 4.5 or 5 degrees as the upper range of global warming. It's not. We are currently exceeding that scenario. And one hopes that we don't continue to exceed it for too long into the future. Sea level rise is very simple. It's based upon basic thermodynamics. The amount that the ocean sea level will rise is pretty much hardwired now, because it takes a very long time for the sea level to equilibrate to the temperature and to the emissions. So out to 2100, there is variability in the amount the ocean sea levels will rise. It is still partly related to emissions. So the good news story is, if the planet does cut emissions along the 2.6 scenario, which is a dramatic and deep cut in emissions, we can limit sea level rise significantly relative to emitting at the rates that we're currently emitting. Tropical cyclones, this is a noisy slide. The central slide for the South Pacific I've labelled. So the first bar on each of these panels is the change in future tropical cyclone activity for all kinds of cyclones. The second bar is cyclones in the category 4 to 5. The third bar is the maximum intensity of the cyclone. And the fourth one is the precipitation rate. And that South Pacific region is the one relevant to most of Australasia. And we are expecting to see a reduction in the frequency of cyclones and a small increase in the rainfall intensity. But there are other places you can go to, for instance, the North Atlantic, where there is a small reduction in the overall frequency of cyclones and, on average, a significant increase in the Cat 4s and 5s, with increases in both the maximum intensity and the rainfall rate. But the short story with cyclones is it's really hard. It really is rocket science. It depends where you are. It depends upon the local oceanography, the local atmospheric processes, and it's to do with a whole range of things to do with how the tropics are expanding and things called storm tracks are heading towards the poles. So if you want to know about tropical cyclones, you have to invest significant skin in the game over the region of choice and understand it to a sufficient level of detail to make your own decisions. Last thing I want to touch on very briefly is cumulative CO2 emissions. So the first of these two panels, the upper panel, shows you a range of future emissions varying only in time, not in amount, but only in time. So some of them have a rapid stabilization of CO2 emissions, others delay that. Some have a very rapid cut in emissions, others delay that. And the bottom panel shows the consequential change in temperature. And the short story here is it doesn't matter when the CO2 is emitted. It matters that the CO2 was emitted. It's the total amount of CO2 that's emitted that matters, not the timing of the emissions. So you can happily go on emitting a lot now if you cut really deeply in the future, or you can begin to cut earlier, and that gives you a bit longer before you reach your total budget. And it turns out, therefore, that it's not a question of climate science. It's a question of economics. How fast does the global community choose to reduce emissions? So every ton of CO2 causes the same amount of warming, no matter when or where it's emitted. In short, there appears to be a hard limit if we wish to avoid 2 degrees of global warming, and that limit appears to be about 1,000 billion tons. So it's not a budget like you lot have, which increases by hopefully 25% a year, or 1 or 2% if you're lucky. It's a hard limit forever, 1,000 billion tons. We've emitted 550 to date, or by 2011, so we're emitting about 10 billion tons a year, so you can do the math. This assumption doesn't take into account some nasty surprises like outgassing of methane from the permafrost, slowing of biospheric sinks, or a whole range of other ways that you can accelerate the rate of CO2 and other greenhouse gas emissions. So the short story is, as you might have been reading in the press recently, if the planet wants to limit global warming to 2 degrees, virtually all of the coal and gas that's in the ground has to stay there. And that's a reality not built from a vague perception, but actually the fundamental energy balance of the planet. So, let's assume you want to stay to 2 degrees. I don't know where the 2 degree number comes from particularly, because I've noticed quite a rapid acceleration of extreme events occurring internationally with 0.8 degrees of warming. And if we're seeing those changes with 0.8 degrees, it's hard to imagine that 2 degrees is safe, but let's just take the 2 degrees for a moment. If you want a 75% chance, so you're going to risk 25% here, but let's take a 75% chance of not exceeding 2 degrees. If emissions continue to grow, we're going to run out of the global carbon budget in about 6 years' time. If you think we're going to turn that around in the next 5 years, you're an optimist, and I admire you for it. If we can cut emissions at 2% a year, the total global carbon budget runs out in about 2030. In short, as I said at the beginning, I hope you filled in your feedback forms because the last bit gets depressing. I think there is a snowball's chance in hell that the planet will avoid 2 degrees. And remember, 2 degrees is the global average. 2 degrees global mean means 4 degrees over land, and 6 to 8 degrees in the extreme events. So if you think of 47 degrees over Melbourne plus 8, it starts to be fairly unpleasant. It's the extremes that get you. It's not the changes in the averages. So in short, my take-home message, which is relevant to you lot, I think, is we are going to have to invest very heavily in building resilience, minimizing our vulnerability, and developing urgently a detailed understanding of our vulnerability to climate, because planning for very significant climate change is, first of all, the clear message from the IPCC, and I think the clear message from the rates at which global policymakers are implementing deep cuts in CO2. Thank you.